So if you want to, you can open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 8, and that's where we'll be taking our first passage from in just a minute. Before we do that, I want to share with you a quote by C.S. Lewis that has meant something to me. He wrote this in The Problem of Pain. He said, "There have been times when I think we do not desire heaven. But more often I find myself wondering whether in our heart of hearts we have ever desired anything else." You see, I think that what he's saying is something that has a lot of truth to it. And that is that a lot of times we consider that we get distracted by all of these other ambitions and all of these other comforts and all of these other joys that the world has to offer. And it sort of seems like our life and our walk with the Lord is just sort of this ongoing struggle to say, okay, I want to choose the joy of the Lord and not the joy of the world. I want to choose God's things and not the world's things. But I think what C.S. Lewis is saying, and what actually has a lot of truth to it, is that anything good that we pursue is because it has some echo of something heavenly in it. I think that we all realize deep down that we were not made for this world. I think all of us know that there is an aching and there is a longing within us for things that nothing in this world can ever satisfy. And yet, there are things in this life that are just good. I mean, there's just no two ways around it. There are things that are just objectively good. If you've ever been with a small child who just laughs, I mean, that's a good thing. And if that doesn't warm something deep inside of you, then, I mean, I don't know what to say, but like, that's just a good thing that everybody acknowledges. If you've ever been just around good company, around good friends or good family, where everybody is just sort of in a good mood and relaxed, and you just take a moment to say, like, this is just a really good thing that's happening right here. I even think about the moments when the sun begins to set, and there's that golden hour where the sunlight just sort of peeks through the leaves. And I think in all of those things that there is almost a heavenly quality to those. That those joys and those pleasures are sort of transcendent and foretaste of the joy that we have to come. And it's in that kind of vein that I want us to think about, what is this future glory of discipleship? Because really the whole series this week has been building up to this night. We've been talking about first what the cost of discipleship is. And then we've talked about how our lives are transformed as we follow Jesus. There's this transformation of discipleship. And then we looked at Jesus' prayer for disciples, where he prayed for 5 specific things, but really we said this is all about this intrapersonal glory of God that he wants us to share in, and that there's this present glory of discipleship that we talked about last night. That there is a way to live your life right now that is glorious and it's splendid and it's magnificent, no matter what the world thinks of it. And it's by gaining Christ and by letting other people see God's character in you that that's glory. But we've noted this whole time that that's not where Jesus' prayer ended. That in Jesus' prayer, he said, "Father, now glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed." And Jesus said things like, "The glory that I have given to them." And he said things like, "I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am to see my glory." And so there's this glorious way that we can live now. There's this glory of discipleship. But Jesus was not bashful about saying that there is a future glory that I'm about to receive and that I want my disciples to receive too. And so what's that all about? Well, the reason I had you turn to Hebrews chapter 8 is because I want to begin reading in verse 1. And I want you to see this really strange but fascinating teaching about the tabernacle that's here. And it teaches us a principle about what we have on earth compared to what we will have in heaven, I believe. So Hebrews chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices, thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Okay, here's the thing that I want you to see about this. In Hebrews chapter 8, the writer is talking about the tabernacle. And the first thing I want to say about the tabernacle is, the tabernacle would have been something that was just amazing. I mean, just amazing. If you were an Israelite, the idea that you could build this tent and that the camp, the Israelite camp, could be around it, and that God would dwell in the middle of the people, would be an amazing thing. That would be a good thing and a wonderful thing. And yet, here's what Hebrews tells us. Is that that tent, that tabernacle in verse 5, was just a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. And that we have this high priest that is not a high priest like the Levitical priesthood. He didn't come from Aaron. He came from this other kind of Melchizedek priesthood. And that when Jesus serves as a high priest for us, that he's not actually in some physical tent. He's not just in a tabernacle. He's gone into heaven itself for us. But the connection between the tabernacle and heaven is that it says here in verse 5 that when Moses was about to build the tent or the tabernacle, God told him, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." So the tabernacle, the tent, was just sort of a copy and a shadow of the real thing that was actually in heaven. He says something similar in chapter 9. Look in Hebrews 9 and verse 23. "Thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf." And so, again, we see this contrast between the copies of the heavenly things that were on earth versus the real thing, heaven itself, that was actually in heaven that the copies were based on. And so I think that there's this principle that we can see, that the good things that God gave the Israelites, those good things on earth, the tabernacle, where God would dwell among his people, it was a good thing, but it was only a copy. It was only a shadow of the real things that were in heaven. Okay, you might think about it this way. You might think about if I gave a toy car to my son, Milo. Milo is 11 months old, and I can bet that I could find a car that he would really like. Most likely one that made a lot of sounds and made a lot of flashing lights, and the sound was really loud and couldn't be turned off easily. Like, that would be the kind of toy he would love. And he would like that toy without really having any kind of conception that it was a car. It would just be this, like, interesting thing to put his mouth on, right? But maybe, like, in a year or two, he would start to say, "I really like this toy because it's a really cool car." And he might like, you know, the fenders on it, and he might like the spoiler on it, and he might like the big tires on it. And so that might be okay for a while, but eventually, hopefully, Milo grows up And one day he gets a driver's license, and one day he starts to drive a real car. Okay, so how do you think that a 16-year-old would react if you said, okay, we're going to take away the real car and we're going to give you the toy car again? Well, he wouldn't want the toy anymore because he's had the real thing. And so that's sort of the principle that we're seeing here, is that things that are copies of the real thing are pretty cool. I mean, there are things that are copies of the real thing that we might think are great and awesome and wonderful, but they're just copies. And the real thing is so much better. The actual heaven itself and the glory of the future far exceeds any glory that we have here. That's the idea. And so Hebrews teaches us that about the tabernacle, but I think that we can see this in more things than just the tabernacle. That this principle is true in a lot of different ways. That what we have on earth may be good, but there are heavenly things that are better and more real that we can look forward to in the future. So turn to Romans chapter 8, and I want to show you this. Romans chapter 8, and we'll begin reading in verse 18. Paul writes, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Okay, the first thing that I want you to see in this text is that there is this contrast that's being made. Paul is contrasting the sufferings with the glory. He's contrasting the present time with what is to be revealed to us. And so you've got these two categories. You've got the present, the here and the now, versus the eternal, versus heaven itself. And he makes this contrast about a couple of different things. Specifically, one thing he says is he talks about the creation in verse 19. That the creation waits for this transformation to take place. I really like God's creation. I'm not really in a position to be critical about it. You know, if I didn't like God's creation, I don't know if I could really critique it too much. But I think God did a pretty good job when he made this world. And maybe you're like me, and maybe you've seen some things in creation that are just pretty spectacular. Maybe you've been standing at the base of some magnificent mountain and just felt utterly minuscule in the presence of it. Maybe you've looked across the Grand Canyon and just seen such vastness that somehow it speaks to the vastness of the mind of a God who would create that. Or maybe you've stood at the base of a waterfall and just felt it pounding in your chest. And you've seen these things and you felt these things and perhaps even been moved by how majestic God's creation can be. And yet, what Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8 is that that creation, it's subject to decay. That as wonderful as it is and as glorious as it might seem, that it's just passing away. That's not the ultimate thing. That's not the greatest thing, but he talks about that this creation will be redeemed and restored. And that right now it's just sort of like a copy of the heavenly things. He doesn't just say that about the creation, but he also says in verse 23, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Paul also spoke about our bodies in this way. That just like the creation is a good thing that is ultimately going to pass away to something better, our bodies are like that too. Now, we could do the same thing about the bodies that God's designed. Some of you may have studied the human body. Some of you may have some experience in anatomy or physiology or medicine. Our bodies are pretty spectacular things. They can grow, they can reproduce, they can heal themselves, they can filter toxins, they can be unbelievably resistant to disease and injury at times. And David rightly wrote in Psalm 139, "I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Our bodies are amazing, but the principle is that our bodies are still only a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. Let me show you another place where Paul writes about our bodies and the hope that we have, this future glory for our bodies. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul uses some of the same language again, specifically in reference to the bodies that we have. In verse 16, "So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." Okay, again, notice that there's this basic contrast being made. There's this contrast between what we see versus what we can't see. Between what's momentary and what's transient, or sort of like passing, versus what is eternal and what is glorious. That there's this contrast between the two. And Paul describes his suffering and his affliction in a way that any of us would think, "Well, Paul, you're just being ridiculous." Did you notice that in verse 16, or verse 17, he says, "This light, momentary affliction." If you turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11 on your own time and read about the sufferings that Paul went through, as he talks about being stoned and being out at sea and being in perils of his own countrymen and being just going through all of this terrible stuff, and you read the book of Acts and you read about how many times Paul's body was beaten, I mean, it's really hard to read that and say that in any way you could describe that as light. There's no way you could say that that affliction was light unless the glory was so much greater. Unless the hope that Paul had for the future so far exceeded the pain that he went through in his life that it was almost like that affliction was insignificant. There's some interesting wordplay going on in this verse as well, though. He refers to glory in verse 17 in terms of weight. He talks about this eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. That's because in the Hebrew, the word for glory is very closely related to the word for weight. It's actually the same idea there. And I think that we actually understand this more than you might think. Because, so if we think about what glory is worth, glory is magnificence, glory is excellence. And so the idea is that, like, in a marketplace, you would value something by how much it weighed. You would judge something's worth by how much it weighed. We still do the same thing. How many times have you, like, picked up an electronic and just kind of, like, shook it in your hand and said, "Oh, that feels cheap," right? Or you pick up some tool and you say, "Oh, they don't make it like they used to. This feels cheap," right? You evaluate it based on the weight. We associate something that is weighty, something that's heavy, with something that is of quality, something of substance. And that's what Paul is saying, is that this life, the sufferings, the pain, the heartache, the sickness, all of the things that I've gone through, they're just like dust on the scales compared to the glory that awaits us. What a perspective to have. What a heaven-centered perspective to have, that somebody could go through life and go through all the things Paul went through, suffer in all the ways that he suffered, and say, "That's nothing. It's dust. Glory is what awaits me." He keeps talking about this in chapter 5. Let's keep reading in verse 1. For we know that if the tent, that is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up in life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. So notice that Paul uses this analogy here where he talks about the difference between a tent and a house. I like to camp sometimes. I like to sleep out in a tent. I like to be out in creation that way. I don't want to camp all the time. If I slept in a tent every night, that would just be called being homeless, and I don't really want to be homeless. But camping is fun for a little while. And so the way Paul sees his body and the way that Paul sees this life, and specifically his body itself, is he's like, that's just a tent. And so if somebody comes around and like knocks my tent over, that's not such a big deal because it's just the tent. But I have a house. My body is going to be changed. There is a future glory that I have my hope and my trust in. And notice that Paul's hope here, he says explicitly, is not to be found naked. Paul doesn't hope that he would be unclothed. Paul's not saying that one day I hope to just sort of like float away from my body and be this disembodied spirit up in the nebulous heaven. No, but he says, I want this body, I want myself not to be unclothed, but to be further clothed. And the way that he talks about this here is he talks about this idea that there will be more that awaits us in the future. I could show you a lot of different passages in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, but I'll show you two verses there. Paul writes extensively about the resurrection and what the hope of glory that we have is in that resurrection. But I just want to point something out in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 52. He says, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, the trumpet will sound and the dead will be raised imperishable and we shall be changed. For this perishable body must put on the imperishable, and this mortal body must put on immortality. And so the hope that we have is not that one day we're going to be separated from our bodies. It's not that we're going to be floating away from our bodies, but it's that these bodies, these very bodies that we have, that will be buried in the ground, that they will be raised, they will be changed, they will be glorified. And that's important because I think it teaches us this principle again. Because it's just like the tabernacle. That the tabernacle was a copy of the heavenly things. And so the principle is that God gives us good things, but then he switches them out and makes them into better things. Or maybe, I guess, the more accurate way to say that is God gives us perfect things, sin ruins it, but then God restores it or redeems it or makes it what it was made to be all along. And so we've looked at these passages to say, okay, this is the hope that we have, that like the tabernacle was a copy of the heavenly things, that it was great, but it was not as great as heaven itself, that the creation is sort of like this copy of the heavenly things, and it's going to be restored, and it's going to be redeemed. Our bodies are like that too, but could we say this about more? What about our relationship with God itself? Is there a way that we could think about our relationship with God today as sort of just being a copy and a shadow of what we hope for in eternity? We read about ways that we can be incredibly close to God. Hebrews 4 and verse 16 says we can draw near to the throne of grace with confidence. Hebrews 9 and verse 22 says, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith. And so the Bible tells us that because of what Jesus has done, we can be very close to God. We can know God and we can walk with God. But is there a way that what we have with God now is only a copy of what we hope for in eternity? I think so. Look in 1 Corinthians 13. And I want to show you this principle. in regards to our relationship with God. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 12. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. You see the contrast again? Now and then, present and future. But in verse 13 he says, so now faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. What's the teaching? Well, I think that what we can get from this verse is that our relationship with God right now is composed primarily of three parts. That if you know God, if you love God, if you have a relationship with God, that that is based on faith, hope, and love. But Paul says that love is the best. Why is love the best? Well, in the context of this chapter, Paul is talking about things that will pass away, things that will end. He talks about prophecies, they'll pass away. Tongues will cease. But what he said in verse 8 about love is that love never ends. And so here's what this means for us and our hope for this future glory. Is that as close as we can be to God right now, and as much joy as we can have in our relationship with God right now, that there is a hope for a future closeness and a future joy that far exceeds any kind of relationship with God you can have here. And the reason why is because those three things will be changed. Right now, our relationship with God is based on faith, but one day we're not going to need faith anymore. It'll become sight. And right now, our relationship with God is based on hope, but hope will one day be realized. You don't hope for something that you already have. One day we'll have it and hope will go away. But love never ends. Love is the thing that will endure. When our faith becomes sight and when our hope is realized, it'll only be love. Love never ends. We'll see God and love will endure forever. And as the psalmist said in Psalm 16:11, in your presence there is fullness of joy. Heaven becomes this restoration of what was lost in Eden, that God once again lives with His people. And we won't have any need for faith anymore. We won't have any need for hope anymore. We'll just have love. And so that relationship will be even better. I think this principle is so helpful for us to understand that the things that we have on earth that are good things are only copies of the heavenly things to come. I think it helps us to understand some teachings in Scripture that might be difficult for us. I'll be honest with you. There's a particular teaching of Jesus that I really struggled with for a long time. And it's found in Matthew chapter 22, and it's found in Mark chapter 12. And it's this story where the Sadducees come to Jesus and they say, okay, Jesus, you believe in a resurrection, riddle us this. And they come up with this, like, really weird situation, but there is this guy who had, there were seven brothers, and the first one was married to this woman, and he died. And so, because they didn't have any offspring, they didn't have any children, the second brother came along and married the woman as well, and so on, all the way down. All seven brothers have been married to the same woman. And they say, Jesus, you tell us, how is that going to work in the resurrection? Whose wife will she be? And you know what Jesus says. Jesus says, well, in the resurrection, there is no marriage. They neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they're like angels. That bothered me. You know, I just really struggled to understand, how could somebody live a life in love with somebody? How could somebody spend 20, 30, 50, 70 years together, and then suddenly go to heaven and not be married and just be okay with that? And I think that this teaching is so helpful because what it shows me is that I can trust God. Is that even if my relationship with my wife is going to be changed, that when God changes something, He always changes it for the better. It might not be marriage in the way that we think about marriage, but it won't be less than the marriages that we have. And so that's where we have to do. is that we have to learn to trust God, that God has never failed. God has never disappointed those who have hoped in Him. That when He changes something, when He switches it out, it's always something better. And so as wonderful as our marriages and our relationships with each other might be here and now, in heaven they won't be any less. They may be changed, but when God changes something, He always makes it better. And so I want to ask you tonight, do you think you can trust God about that? Do you think that anybody's going to get to heaven and be disappointed? Do you think anybody's going to show up and just be like, oh man, I would have arranged things differently here? Or has God given you enough evidence? Has God given you enough reason to trust Him that you can know that nobody's ever going to be disappointed? I believe with all my heart that we can trust that God will not disappoint us. And one specific reason is because of what He did with the promised land. You remember that whole story in the Old Testament that God was bringing His people, His chosen people up out of Egypt, and He made great promises to them. As early as Exodus chapter 3, God was telling the nation of Israel, hey, when you get to Canaan, when you get to this promised land, you're going to find a place that flows with milk and honey. As a kid, I always deliberated about which stream I would run to first, the milk stream or the honey stream. But, you know, like the idea is that God was saying, it's just going to be awesome. There's going to be no lack of food, no lack of joy, no lack of pleasure. You're going to have everything that you want there. He said that as early as Exodus 3, right as He brought them up out of Egypt. But then when the spies went into the land, Numbers 13, Israel sent 12 spies into the land. And you remember that they were freaked out. I mean, they saw these giants, they saw these people, and they said, there's no way we can defeat them. There's no way we can take this. And they were scared, and they were punished for that. But when they were asked the question, okay, but what did the land look like? What did they say? They said, it's a land that flows with milk and honey. God had been right the whole time. He had been telling them, it's going to be great, you're not going to be disappointed, it's going to be wonderful, and they were too scared to take it. They didn't have enough faith to trust God to take it. But as far as evaluating what God had told them, they said, it's all true. It's all true. They brought back this huge cluster of grapes to prove it. Exactly what God had promised. Let me show you a place where God also spoke of the promised land. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 6. I find this fascinating. So this is many years later, after the spies had brought this bad report, and after Israel had wandered around in the wilderness, and Moses now is at the end of his life, and there's this new generation that by faith will succeed where the previous one had failed. They are actually going to go into the promised land. And these are the promises that God makes through Moses to the children of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 11. Let's start in verse 10. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant, when you eat and are full. You see, God was telling the nation of Israel, you're going to get into this land, and you're going to live in houses you didn't build, you're going to have farms, you're going to have vineyards, your tables are going to be full. But what was the nation of Israel doing when God made those promises? They weren't living in houses, they were living in tents. They weren't eating great feasts from vineyards that they didn't plant, they were eating manna that fell from heaven. And they weren't drinking milk or wine, they were drinking water out of rocks. You see the parallel? Is that Israel was in tents, eating manna, drinking water. God said, I'll give you houses, I'll give you vineyards, I'll give you honey, I'll give you milk. It makes me think of Hebrews 11 in verse 15 that talks about these great men and women of faith. And it says, if they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared for them a city. The point for us is we're a lot like Israel. God gives us some good things. God gives us tents to dwell in. He gives us manna from heaven. He gives us water out of rocks. He gives us beautiful creation to enjoy, and He gives us great bodies that meet our needs. He allows us to have a closeness in our relationship with Him, and He allows us to have joy in the relationships that we have with each other. But God keeps saying, I've got something better for you. Don't think that this is it. Don't think that this is the greatest thing that I have. There's future glory that awaits my people. And I just think that we get this so backwards sometimes. I think sometimes we think of like the here and now as being the real thing. And we think of heaven as sort of being ethereal. We think about like being in heaven as like, you know, just being a disembodied spirit and floating along on a cloud and maybe somebody's playing a harp or something like that. But the point is that the tabernacle was the copy. It was the shadow. The thing on earth wasn't the real thing. The real thing is what was in heaven. One other passage I'll show you on this. Look in 1 John chapter 3. I'll fully admit that we are on the fringes of what we're capable of understanding. I don't presume to know everything about what heaven will be like. I don't know exactly what that glory that awaits us will feel like or look like. And if you're like me and you're sort of confused about all of this too and not really sure what to make of it, you're in good company. Because the Apostle John pretty much says the same thing here. In 1 John chapter 3 and verse 1, he says, see what kind of love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. Beloved, we are God's children now. And what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him, because we shall see Him as He is. Don't you love that? John says, we're God's children right now. See how much God loves us? See how much God has blessed us? But there's going to be something better in the future. And what that'll be like, John says, I have no idea. I have no idea. But John said, we'll be like Jesus. Because we'll see Him as He is. And if that was enough for John, that's going to be enough for me. We'll see Him as He is. And we'll share in His glory in eternity. Now, that's not the last thing John said, though. And here's where we sort of make this application back to discipleship one last time. In verse 3, he says, and everyone who thus hopes in Him purifies himself as He is pure. I think that what John is telling us is that we hope for this future transformation. We hope for this future glory, but it is a transformation and a glory that has already begun in people who are following Jesus. That we right now are purifying ourselves because we hope for this future purity that God has to offer for us. It's why we pray things like, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And the thing that makes heaven wonderful, is that God reigns and nothing rebels against Him. In heaven, there's nobody that opposes Him. In heaven, there is nothing that resists Him. God's rule is perfect. God reigns completely. Every enemy has been defeated. Every enemy has been cast out. And so the point for us is that the more that we make Christ the king of everything that we think and say and do in this place right now, the more and more our lives look like heaven today. The more this church learns to submit to the rule of Christ and the way that you treat each other, the more this church looks like heaven. The more your family focuses on the things that God says are important, the more you submit as a family to Christ, the more your family looks like heaven. The more you're changed, the more you purify yourself, the more heavenly you become every day. And so the copies of the heavenly things become truer and truer versions of the originals. Heaven comes down. God's will on earth is done as it is in heaven. And as Proverbs 4 and verse 18 says, the path of the righteous shines brighter and brighter until full day. I think when that happens, as we get serious about being disciples of Jesus Christ, that there is a twinkling and a glimmer of heaven on earth. We might convince ourselves that we have these competing desires and these competing joys and these competing pleasures, but I believe that in our heart of hearts, none of us wants anything less than that. That real blessedness and real glory is found only in the kingdom of heaven, submitting to the kingly rule of Christ, both now and for eternity. Last passage that I'll reference is in Revelation chapter 14. I've always really appreciated the way God's people are described in this passage. We've talked about how discipleship primarily means following Jesus. Following Him, wherever He leads, whatever He does, becoming like Him, having fellowship with Him, making His mission our mission, making His character our character. In Revelation 14, it's just this very simple statement that describes those people that are God's people. And it's in verse 4. It says, "It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless." When we see the righteous in heaven, when we see those who are experiencing the future glory of discipleship, it's because they decided to follow Jesus. They followed Him when He first said to them, "Follow Me." And they let their nets down and they walked away from what was precious to them. They followed Him as He told them difficult things about how they needed to change. And they became so enraptured with who He is that they said, "I don't want my own character. I don't want my life. I want Your life. I want to be like You." They followed Him through the transformation. They followed Him through the persecution. They followed Him into a glorious life on earth. But eventually those people follow Jesus all the way to the throne of God. And I just got to say, I want to see you there. This has been a great few days, but it hasn't been enough. And one day, we will experience glory together. If there's somebody here that needs to decide to follow Jesus, you can take that first step tonight. This is what life is all about. This is what gives your life purpose. This is what gives your life joy. God has never disappointed those who have trusted in Him. He never said that the road would be easy, but He assures us that it's a decision that we would never regret. If you want to follow the Lamb wherever He goes, the invitation is the Lord's, and He invites you now while we stand together and sing.